taxation number 21025, real 1.
Laurie Brown, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
A little village called Edmondsley, County Durham.
Where is it near?
It's near here, 3 miles away.
From Chesterley Street?
From Chesterley Street, yeah.
Which year was this?
1923.
Did both your mother and father come from this village?
No, my father came from a village called Coxhall. That's out. About 6 miles from County Durham. And my mother came from a little place called Sacriston, another little village about 4 miles from here.
Did you have your schooling in this village?
In Sacriston.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
Oh, 14.
So we're talking about 1937?
37, yes.
Did you get your job when you left?
Yes, I went to the what you call working on the belts at the coal mines. That was picking the stone out of the coal. Horrible job.
Why was it so horrible?
Well, it was dirty. It was. You can imagine men working down the mines. A lot of beer drinking them days. The coal was tipped onto the screens. It came down a big wide belt, and there could be everything among it and. No heat, no nothing, and the coal dust was just thrown all over you. It was a terrible, horrible job.
Which pit was this?
This was Sacriston.
Is that the job you were doing when war was declared?
No. I had to go down the mine at 16. I wouldn't go. So I was out of work. But there's a garage down here. It used to be a big Ford place. And I took a test and got a job there as an apprentice mechanic. But I had two brothers on long-distance lorries. One had went and the war had started, of course. One had been an old soldier. He was called back. And my other brother got a new wagon and trailer. So I started with him as a trailer boy. And I was with him until I was called up to the forces.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on
yes,
Germany?
Yes, I did. Yes, I remember that very well. Yeah.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I thought it was. My father was in the Great War, and I thought it was something exciting. You know, I didn't realise, for all I'd heard about the war, my father telling the stories, and I just thought it was exciting to, you know, a war. But I never dreamt I would be a soldier.
Did the war affect you at first?
Well, yes, because while I was a trailer boy on the wagon and trailer, we carried bombs from here to Chorley in Lancashire.
Bombs?
Empty bombs to be filled, 500-pound bombs, to be filled in Chorley, outside Liverpool, but we're what you call truck drivers. My brother and I took the wagon and trailer down overnight, handed it over to another driver and second man. They delivered the bombs, loaded the wagon and trailer again in Liverpool for return to Newcastle, what you call a trunk service, you know. So I saw Liverpool bombed from the top of the Pennines. We were going to Liverpool, to Chorley that night, and we saw the red glow, you know, on the top of the Pennines, and we couldn't get into Liverpool that day. The gas, the electric, Tate and Lyles had been hit, the sugar refinery, and the whole place was on fire. So we went all night, all day, and practically all night again before we got any rest. But still, the wagon and trailer had to be turned round, you know, to keep the essential foods going, like, yeah.
Did you think at that time the Germans might win the war?
Oh, without a shadow of doubt, yeah.
Were you listening to wireless at that time?
Yes.
What type of things would you...
Well, in 1940, when Dunkirk happened, of course, everybody, the whole attitude of everybody, I think, was saying, we're finished. Before long, the Germans would be here. That's when I began to take it seriously. You know? And of course, then I was called up in May 42, when I was called up. I went to Clitheroe in Lancashire. I think we were the first, what you call, general service soldiers.
Before that, had you been in any bombing of England yourself?
Well, I'd watched Newcastle was bombed. I'd been on the... Our depot was on the quayside, and a bomb had dropped on what you call Newmarket goods station. And it was just... from our depot, I would think it would be half a mile. And of course, there's a railway on the main, what we, the motorway now, no, the old A1, there's a bridge that carries the trains from here to London. And there was a parachute bomb dropped. And it just missed the bridge by a few yards. Still there to see where the trees had blown away, you know, and I remember that blast. That was before I went into the army, yeah.
How did you feel like being called up to the army?
Excited. Very excited. A new life.
Where did you report to?
Clitheroe in Lancashire.
What happened to you there?
Pardon?
What happened to you there?
I did 6 weeks. Then I was selected for the Royal Armoured Corps.
What was your initial training like?
Rough, tough, really rough and really tough. It was 6 weeks of hell, I must say that, but after that 6 weeks, I was fitter than I'd ever been in my life. You know, you learned to be a soldier, you either made it or you didn't. Because the big dining hall, there was 12 to a table, and you used to go, ATS girls served behind the counter. You go and collect the meat, the potatoes, whatever it was, you know. Now, if the bullies was round the table, they dished it out to the mates, you got none. So you had to learn to look after yourself. That's about all, you know. It was tough. But it was... The comradeship was absolutely wonderful.
Were you treated fairly by the people in charge of the training?
Well, treated, I would think so, but it was rough. I've seen and I heard many a lad crying himself to sleep. We weren't allowed out those 6 weeks, you know. In PT kit, then in full kit, and then in this kit, and it was really tough. And you went for route marches and everything. Your feet were examined. You marched to the dentist for your teeth. It was a complete new world. I'd roughed it on the wagon and trailer, you can imagine. But this was something new, completely.
Were you able to cope with what they expected you to do?
Oh, yes. I'd roughed it, but a lot couldn't. A hell of a lot couldn't.
And after Clitheroe?
I went to Kattrick, to the Royal Armoured Corps. Taught to drive, but I could drive at the time. Gunnery. W2 wireless operation, driving the tanks. Because our tanks weren't so good them days, as you probably know, we had the Matilda, which was out in the desert, and the old Crusader. But there were no... The majority had the little two-pounder gun on, you know, and a Beezer machine gun. There were no comparison to the German gun, you know.
Any experiences that happened to you at Catterick?
None really, just we had barrack rooms and life wasn't so bad. And with Catterick, you know, and being on the lorries, I could walk from Catterick camp down to Catterick village. Of course, I was known on the roads there and I had a lot of friends I'd met, and I could get a lift to Chesley Street here and get a bus home for the weekend, which I wasn't supposed to do, but we did. And maybe bring a mate home with us, you know. It wasn't a bad life at all, I don't think, then.
What job were you being trained for on the tanks?
Well, we trained for everything, really. You had to, you know, them days, you only had 2 shilling a day. We had the same wages as what you got in the Great War. 2 shillings a day. And then you had to pass to be a driver IC, as they called it. That's a driver in charge, I think. And you got 6 months a day on top. And then I think if you were classed as a soldier, you got another 6 months a day proficiency pay. So that was 3 shillings a day. And I did that, I think it was 3 months in Catterick. Yes, I went to Catterick in the July. 3 months later, I went to Charing in Kent to the 9th Royal Tank Regiment.
What did you find at Charing?
Oh, well, it was midnight when we got there after a terrible train journey. We picked up by wagons and I was taken to this little village called Stallersfield. And it was blackout, dark, and we just put in those Nissen huts and other type of huts, and I was put in this employed hut, they called it. Of course, there was a big fire in the middle. Cold. I was told to get a palias, but it was empty. I had to fill it with straw and bed down for the night. And I remember this very well. The Sergeant Major was called Sergeant Major Board. He was there for he was the waiting of a replacement, but he was from Southern Command. And the kid me in the Nissenhood, I would have to go and meet this Sergeant Major Plank, because he was called Bord, you see. And I remember, I still see the man today, he's 90-year-old, he's there at the reunions. I knocked at the office door, and it was this Lance Corporal Edwards, and I said, I've got to see Sergeant Major Plank. And he said, don't call him Sergeant Major Plank, whatever you do. He's Sergeant Major Bord. That was my first learning, you know. So, and of course, then I was allocated to this employed, but that meant I was going to be driving 3 tonners, the CO, or anything like that, you know, any sort of driving duty. But still, I had to go on the South Downs and passed my driving test on the Churchill tank.
What was the Churchill like after the others?
Well, it was what they call them changes, it was a gate change, you know? Do you know what I mean by a gate change? I believe it was a 5-speed gearbox. It had, I know it was a Bedford engine, you know, but it was a massive engine. It was 6 cylinders either side opposed, flat, and it had 2 carburetors on like that. And you didn't use the starter motor to start it, you used a donkey engine to preserve your batteries, you know. But you had to pass that test. But after that, I was what you call driving the echelon wagon. At nights, I would take, it was called a passion wagon, T take them to Faversham for a night out, Maidstone for a night out, Ashford for a night out. And I was there right the way through to leaving that part of the country. We did a lot of schemes. I don't know if you ever heard of it, Spartan. This was really rough.
This was an exercise, was it?
Exercise on the South Downs. It lasted about 6 weeks. And it was tough. I can show you some photographs of this. And
in what way was it so tough?
Well, you slept rough. This was to get you used to war conditions, to try and get you used to war conditions. But it was, you try to feed yourselves off the land and everything, really live it rough. And then after that, we did a lot of schemes. From there I went to Castle Martin in Wales to do gunnery. And I came up to Walkup outside Kirby Stevens and did gunnery. But I was employed on the passion wagons all the time. And then while we were on schemes, you would have 3 tonne of petrol on, but not the jerry cans, the stupid British cans, which is a square can. And they're always leaked. Terrible cheap things.
Terrible what?
Cheap. Tuppence halfpenny tin, but we adapted the jerry can. It was found on the desert and we adapted it, you know that.
What was the difference between the British cans and the jerry can?
The British can was made of pure tin and it was soldered together and it had no air system. Once you broke it, you know how you pour with just one hole. You had to hear it like that and get 2 holes in it. And you spilt more than what you put in the tank. But the jerry can, have you ever seen a jerry can?
No.
Well, they use them to this day. It had a breather in. So once you opened it, you could pour it in your tank without spilling a drop. But as I say, I would carry petrol or ammo for the tanks. And I drove the 3-ton lorry, the Bedford QL, to Gosport, where we went to France. No, I couldn't tell you one date. I'm not sure of the date. It was sometime in June, but it certainly wasn't D-Day.
What was your crossing like?
Well, I went over in an American boat and we got fed going across. I'd never had food like it for years. But I still didn't realise I was going to a war. Somehow it just didn't, it didn't materialise somehow, I don't know. But the crossing, no bother. We landed, and of course, you know, wagons and tanks weren't automatically sealed down days. I spent 2 weeks in Great Yarmouth learning how to seal a wagon and a tank. We used Bostik and plasticine. And the tank, you put the exhaust up in the air, you know, so the water couldn't get into it. And the wagons, you sealed all your plugs, your carburetor, your distributor, and all your breathers on your gearbox and on your back end, if you know what I mean. That's your, where Cromwell and Pinion is, what they call it. But all breathers had to be sealed with a little bit tape. So that when you landed on dry land, the first thing you had to do was release the tape, jump out, release the tape, so that the gearbox, the back end, the engine could breathe. You know, if you didn't, like your petrol cap, if you don't have a breather, it'll blow up. So that was your first thing. No, that was the only thing that worried us. In case I jumped out, and a sniper got his eye on us and shot us while I was doing it. That was, I think that's the only thing that worried us. But I remember we followed the tapes. It was a sign of you. We were the 31st Tank Brigade them days. And we went into this little place called St. Gabriel, round the field and everything. I can remember that. And the first thing I saw was a German lying there. He'd been shot through the head, straight through his helmet. And it dawned on us, this wasn't a scheme on the South Downs. This was a war, you know. Excuse me, like a glass of water?
Yeah.
And that night I was picked out to have to be on guard. So I remember I was on guard, and of course in the army there's every type of man you can imagine. There was a college boy, and we'd bivouacked off the side of the wagons, you know, and the tanks. And here's this bloke, we had to dig latrines. He comes out in pyjamas to go out the latrines. We're in war, you know, he's in pyjamas. I'm on guard, I'm only a kid. And I shouted, "Hold, who goes there?" And there was a lieutenant there, I remember his name, Lieutenant Pickett. He must have heard, and he jumped up, and he nearly shot him. And he gave him such a dressing down for having white pyjamas in a, you know, German-occupied town. But that's a thing I remember very well. And then the next morning, I remember we were briefed on who was opposite. I believe it was the Panzer Grenadiers, Panzer Regiment, and such and such, and we're going to a formal point to meet this, which was, you know, it's hard to understand when you're young. But I remember this man cut my hair, Nobby Killick. We all had our hairs cut, you know, on account of lice or anything like that we'll catch. And the first action, the first man to be killed was Nobby Killick. So that sticks in my mind, I know.
How did that happen?
He was on the tank, and he'd put his head out of the to look around, you know, and I believe his head was blown off. But that's one of the big memories I have. And of course, after that, it was, you're scared every day. This German, what you call, Morning Mini, have you ever heard of it?
Yes.
It was such a soul-destroying thing that the screeching of it, and it's what you call stonked, you know, like that. And you, wherever it was, you dived. You try to get cover. And that was the most scary part. Now, once or twice, the tanks went out. We were just behind with the fuel and the ammo to replenish them. And I remember going up with the sergeant, the quartermaster sergeant, to replenish the tank with petrol. And the German Luftwaffe was out. And I could see the green tracer bullets of the Germans, ours was red. And I was scared bloody stiff. Absolutely. It's hard to describe the feeling, what it's like. But we got over it. But then you formed up again, and so had been killed. This one had been killed. It was just people you'd lived with for 2 years. You just couldn't. It was hard to take. But all you could think about, when's my turn coming? You know? And I remember watching, we got the Stars in Battle Dress Rover. And they performed on the back of a 3-ton lorry. And there was a dogfight going on above us. And all of a sudden the shrapnel dropped down like that in front of us. I never watched the Stars in Battle Dress again. I thought, hell, out can happen here. And of course then there was the deer at Malto, or Hill 112. The Germans had counterattacked the echelon, we had to pull back. And at the end of the day, we'd lost 14 tanks and practically 14 crews. And that was 14 men. That was not 14 men. This was about five men in a crew that I'd known for 2 years, lived with them, ate with them, drank with them. And our old technical corporal, I remember, we all cried our eyes out. It was so terrible.
What happened to you at Malta?
Well, I can tell you, at Malta, we pulled out of a place with the echelon. We pulled round this field. There was the other echelons there from ours A squadron. There was B squadron, C squadron, HQ squadron. We pulled round this field. I can remember it like yesterday. It was a Sunday afternoon, and there was trenches in the field, still warm. Bullets in the side of the trenches. The Germans had just left them. You could smell them. The trench was still warm. But we thought they would push them away and we were safe enough. It was a Sunday afternoon, sunshine like today. And everybody stripped off to get a wash and shave. We used to cut these cans in half, boil them, put water in the petrol in the ground, mix it with soil, you know, put a match to it. You know how petrol flows up, flares up, and boil water. So we're having a wash and a shave. I'm standing at this tree, washing and shaving. This is very, another thing that sticks out, is Sergeant Bill Turner from HQ squadron. He was washing and shaving. And all of a sudden, this morning mini must have come back again, and they stomped us, and we dived like hell, like. And I dived, and Bill Turner, I shouted, "Are you all right, Bill?" And he didn't move, and he'd been scalped. The shrapnel had just taken his head away. That's another thing I remember so well. But after that, it was every night you're lying in a ditch, anywhere where you can get below ground level for this stomping used. I remember lying one night, the ditch was full of water, but it just lay there all night. You couldn't come out because we were under fire all the time. Some lads used to sleep under the tanks, you know, but the weight of a tank, 50 ton and soft ground, there was a lot of men killed that way. There was a lot of men killed where it said, "This place is booby-trapped, don't," but men would go and try, and the house would blow up, or the farm, or whatever. And there's a lot of signs, "Don't make dust, you're under enemy observation." And of course, blokes didn't dream the thought of, it was, but you did your best. I did my best to try to avoid make any dust if possible. I was aware there was Germans out there wanting to kill me. And that's about, but then we had the breakthrough. You've probably read the history about it.
Just before the breakthrough, do you remember the infantry you were cooperating with at Malta?
Oh, yes, the Hallams, the DLI, and the Oxenbucks. My heart used to bleed for them. Oh, there was the 51st Highland Division. I don't know who was with it, but I remember the bagpipes playing while they were going into action. Brave, brave men. You know, that's just absolutely. And the infantryman with his little pack and his shovel on his back, and you'd see him lying there in a slip trench, not much bigger than that there. And he lived in that, he ate in that, he drank in that, and he did his business in that. He was a brave man, a very brave man. Well, is there anything else you want to know about that part?
Whilst you were in Normandy, did you have any contact with civilians?
I remember on a farm, we were in this farm orchard, and he come out with his drink called Calvados. And he said the wife was cooking us a meal and they cooked a chicken for us. And I think the French cooked chickens just as they are. They just took the feathers off and cooked it and we couldn't eat it. I remember that very well. But mixing with civilians, there wasn't a lot to see in Normandy.
What opinion did you form of the German enemy in Normandy?
A wonderful, wonderful fighter. I've got to admit that. I've seen a sniper up a tree. You know how they caught a sniper? They had to draw his fire. So they would... He may be in a church steeple, he's maybe up a tree. But they'd send a jeep or something through as fast as possible to get his fire, to find where he was. And...